So if you were at our previous workshop, you would have got a little bit of redemptive history. Some of you may remember that. We spoke about redemptive history in the book of Genesis. And what I'm going to do now is show you how the book of Judges fits into redemptive history. And I'm strongly convinced of this. If you do not understand redemptive history, you will miss the purpose of each book in the Bible and the individual stories that make up each book within the Bible. And so the book of Judges is a story of a nation after Joshua who forgets God and turns to idols. And as a result, God does not deliver the Canaanites into their hands as they battle against them. Book of Judges is really a story of a series of deliverers who demonstrate God's power and his might through mighty acts of deliverance for the people of Israel who had sinned repetitively against God. The words which conclude the book summarize the overarching mood of each story within the book. In those days there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what is right in his own eyes. Judges is best understood in its place in redemptive history. If you don't understand that, you're going to mess up the story of Gideon and Deborah and Barak, and you're going to have your children in Sunday school coloring in pictures of Samson wrestling a lion. Or you can be like Samson too one day. Pray that they are not like Samson too one day. And so to understand redemptive history, what we'll do is focus on understanding what is meant by the term redemptive history, the story of redemptive history leading up to the time of the judges, the content of the book of Judges as it fits into God's plan of salvation. And then finally, we will look at the necessity of the book of Judges in redemptive history. So let's start by answering the question that you may be asking, what is redemptive history? And it's quite obvious. The clue is in the title. It is the story of redemption. The history of God's plan to save mankind. Or put in another way, it is God's mission to glorify himself in the salvation of his people. It is the thread that runs throughout scripture. It is the great purpose of the Bible. It is the great purpose of history. And it's the great purpose of the entire universe. If you want to know why everything the way it is right now and where everything is going, you need to understand redemptive history. To study redemptive history is to study the main story of the Bible. In its essence, it involves creation, the fall, the flood, the call of Abraham, the establishment of the nation of Israel, the Exodus, the giving of the law, the covenant with David and his offspring, the exile and return to the promised land, the incarnation of Jesus Christ, his ministry, his death, burial, resurrection, and ascension into heaven, the proclamation of his kingdom and return, his rule and reign through the vehicle of his church, his second coming, his judgment of all the world, and his reign in righteousness where he will receive worship, honor, and adoration forever and ever. Amen. Before we get into the book of Judges, let us start by discovering how this book fits into the grand redemptive scheme. To begin with, we must start at the beginning of history itself in Genesis chapter 1 and 2. God displayed his great power, his might, his sovereignty and creativity in creating the world. He created everything and declared that it was good. He created it for his own good will and his own good pleasure. This world which God originally made was in a perfect state. And at the pinnacle of God's creation, he made man. Man represented by Adam and Eve were to reflect God's glory as his image bearers. They would be the representatives of all mankind for the rest of history, and not only of mankind, but also of all nature. They were the head of everything created. This is Paul's argument in Romans chapter 5 and also in 1 Corinthians, where he speaks about Christ coming back. When he speaks about Christ's resurrection, that they represented all of nature, and in them all of nature fell into its own sinful decay. They were personally responsible for all of creation, and their choices would directly affect everyone and everything for all times until the return of Christ. Their relationship with God is also vitally important to note, because their relationship with God is what was lost when they would eventually disobey Him. They had perfect communion with God. God was their Father, He was their Lord, and He was their King. He gave them work to do, He gave them laws to obey. He said to them, they are to be fruitful, multiply, subdue the earth, and abstain from eating the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And so when they were tempted to eat of this tree by the devil, they decided that no longer would God be their Lord. No longer would God be their King. They would be like God, knowing both good and evil. God says, I'm number one and you're number two. Obey me. Devil says, if you eat of this tree, you can be number one. Isn't that the exact attitude of every sin that we actually ever commit? God says, don't do it. We say, I want to do it. I will do it. And so we say, not your will, but mine. That is really the root of all sin. The result of their rebellion was devastating. From the point of their sin onwards, humanity would be cursed with toil, work, difficulty in life, death, and separation from God. There would be a people forever marked by rebellion. And worst of all, this fall resulted in them being thrown out of God's presence. However, even in God's curse of mankind, He promised hope of redemption. Genesis chapter 3, verse 15. And it's just one short little verse in the big Bible that we have. But if you miss that one verse, you're going to miss everything that follows. He said, in the seed of the woman, there would come a man to crush the head of the serpent who sowed the seeds of disobedience within our father and mother, Adam and Eve. God promised redemption. God said to the woman that she would have a seed to bruise the head of the serpent. There would be a man to come and destroy the one who has the power of death, namely Satan. And the seed promised to the woman would reunite us with God Himself. The story of redemption, then, is the history of human decay until the arrival of the seed who would deliver us and destroy Satan. Adam and Eve fell from goodness, and the immediate result was the first family feud, Cain and Abel. Cain, with his jealousy of his brother and his anger that overtook him, committed murder. I wonder what that must have been like for Adam. Adam, who knew goodness, who knew what it was like to be without sin or even temptation to sin, who knew what it was like to be in perfect union with God, seeing his children suffering, seeing his children murdering one another, and knowing that it is the direct result of his personal decision to sin. Cain kills Abel. From that point on, Cain's descendants spiral into darkness and anarchy. And you almost wonder, well, what's going to happen? God promised that there would be the seed to redeem man, but Adam and Eve's child, Cain, is just having these descendants that are wicked, 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 wicked. But gratefully we read of Seth, one who replaces Abel, and his lineage begins to call upon the name of the Lord. The problem is that there is this mixing between the lineage of Seth and the lineage of Cain, right up until Genesis chapter 6, where all mankind was totally wicked except for one man, Noah. And so God wipes everyone and everything out through the flood. He preserves Noah and his family and just a small selection of animals, preserves them in the ark. And when they come out of the ark, God renews his covenant promises to them. He says, be fruitful, multiply, subdue the earth. God was preserving mankind because God had a plan to save mankind through the seed of sinful mankind. After the flood, Noah, of course, sins. His sin of drunkenness, and we read about that, and his own son shaming him publicly. And they start to spiral into darkness again. So that by the end of Genesis chapter 11, mankind is totally wicked. They've just built the Tower of Babel. trying to make themselves great, trying to reach up to the heavens themselves, trying to be undefeatable and autonomous, independent of God. God scatters them, of course, and he selects one man, Abram. And he renews his covenant promises to Abram in Genesis chapter 12. In you, the nations of the earth will be blessed. But Abram and his descendants don't exactly act faithfully either. Abram sins. He gives his wife over to other men on at least two occasions. He acts unfaithfully by sleeping with his own servant so that he can bring about God's promises. And his own descendants act very sinfully as well. His grandson deceives his other grandson and his own father so that he could steal the family's inheritance. And that son, whose name is Jacob, has 12 sons who sell one of their own offspring, one of their own brothers, into slavery. So that by the end of Genesis, you see these promised people, the people who are carrying the seed of the woman, the people through whom all of the world is meant to be blessed, are totally wicked people except for one guy, Joseph. But Joseph reminds them of a very important principle. What you meant for evil, God can use for good.
Amen.
To save the world. The drama continues to unfold as God's chosen family grew in Egypt and became enslaved. They were hated by the Egyptians to the point of the king of Egypt, Pharaoh, trying to kill all of their sons. Now, you can imagine the problem here. Genesis 3:15, there's a seed that's coming to bless the nations of the world, to redeem everybody. They almost were wiped out except for Noah. They almost got into trouble through Abraham and his disobedience, but they were preserved. Now they're in Egypt, and Pharaoh is killing them all. How is the world going to be blessed? How is the world going to be saved? God preserves Moses, and through Moses, redeems them out of Egypt by bringing plagues upon the Egyptians, rescuing them out of Egypt, taking them through the Red Sea, and crushing their oppressors behind them. From that point on, they start to wander through the wilderness. Now, three very important things happen here in the wilderness. First is, they receive God's law. They receive God's law because they are God's people and they are meant to reflect his image. Remember, that's why we're here on this earth, to reflect God's image. And so God gives them a law, and that law reflects God's good and pure nature. The God who is truth says don't lie. The God who is faithful says don't cheat on your spouse. The God who provides all things says don't be envious of one another, and so on. He also gives them laws of purity to preserve them and protect them from being like the other nations around them. And really, some of them are just survival techniques to survive the wilderness and the desert wandering. So that's the first thing that happens. The second very important thing that happens is that God dwells with his people in the tabernacle and he establishes a priesthood. God is with his people and God establishes a people to teach his people and keep the tabernacle. And then finally, the people's hearts rebel against God. They show their contempt for him by disobeying his laws. And when they send the scouts into the promised land, which God was going to give them, they come back with a negative report and they rebel and they complain and they moan. And they say, why did we even come out of Egypt in the first place? They would rather be enslaved by man than be liberated by God. And so they rebel against him. And so they have to spend an additional 40 years in the wilderness. After 40 years pass, God used Joshua and Caleb, the two faithful spies, to lead the Israelites into the promised land. Joshua led the Israelites to the Jordan River, where they would observe the Passover, they would be reminded of God's covenant, and they would pass through the Jordan on dry land, just like they passed through the seas of the Red Sea, with the Ark of the Covenant going before them, representing God's presence, God's laws, and his provision with them as they come into the promised land. And that brings you to the book of Joshua. The book of Joshua is really about their conquest. And you see this in Joshua chapter 6. They march around the walls of Jericho. And without even using swords, cause the entire city to crumble. And then they take over. But you also see the seeds of their rebellion. Because it's just after the story of Jericho that you read the story of Ai. And a certain man, keeping for himself some of the treasure that he was not meant to keep, not trust in God. And so you see this conquest, but also within them, this continuous seed of rebellion that they inherited from their great-great-great-great-grandfather and grandmother, Adam and Eve. And so by the end of the story of Joshua, they had come into the land. They were taking over the land, and they received the different land allotments that each tribe was meant to go in and take possession of and drive the Canaanites away from. So that's what's going on when the book of Judges arrives. Judges is the story of Israel inheriting their land from the Canaanites. But instead of driving out all the Canaanites, they actually acted just like the Canaanites. They sinned. God caused these people to be overtaken by wicked men in order to discipline them. This is why God raised up judges or deliverers to save these people from their hands. And the overview of the book of Judges is found in Judges chapter 2. And if you want to look at Judges chapter 2, you can. I just want to read a few quick verses to give you an idea of what the whole book of Judges is about. So in Judges chapter 2, verse 10, you read these very important words. And there arose another generation after them who did not know the Lord or the work that he had done for Israel. In verses 13 to 14, they abandoned the Lord and served Baals and the Ashtaroth. So the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he gave them over to plunderers who plundered them. He sold them into the hand of the surrounding enemies so that they could no longer withstand their enemies. Verse 16, the Lord raised up judges who saved them out of the hands of those who plundered them. We read further, whenever the Lord raised up judges for them, the Lord was with the judge, and he saved them from the hand of their enemies all the days of the judge. For the Lord was moved to pity by their groanings because of those who afflicted and oppressed them. Very interesting. God did not always save his people because they repented. God did not always save his people because they deserved it. God saved his people because he had pity on them. And also because he had a divine plan for them to save the world. He says in Judges chapter 2, verses 21 and 22, I will no longer drive out before them any of the nations that Joshua left when he died, in order to test Israel by them, whether they will take care to walk in the way of the Lord as their fathers did. Thus the story progresses. God raised up judges to deliver his people from judgment. The problem was that the judges were not perfect. They were not good people. In fact, the only perfect thing about them was that they were perfect representatives of the people they were delivering, in that they were sinners themselves. The first judges we read about are not all that bad. You read about Othniel, the one who comes after him, and then Deborah and Barak. But after them, it sort of spirals into decay and darkness. We see Othniel delivering Israel after they commit idolatry and God gives them into the hands of the Canaanites. And the Spirit of the Lord was upon him. This is something you must take care to note. Throughout the book of Judges, what you read is the Spirit of the Lord upon the different judges. This does not mean that God approves of their behavior. This does not mean that God was empowering them necessarily to sin. And immediately you could probably draw some application from that today. A lot of people walk around today, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me and I'm doing all these great and mighty things. Doesn't mean that God is approving of their behavior. Alright? A lot of people misuse the verse, touch not God's anointed, to allow people to sin because they are doing, you know, sort of great acts for the Lord or something. But Jesus Christ himself says in Matthew chapter 7, many will come to me in that day, telling me about all the things that they did in my name, and I'll say, depart from me, I never knew you. Depart from me, you worker of unrighteousness, into everlasting fire. And so, after Othniel, and Barak, and Deborah, we read of Gideon, who demonstrated his lack of trust when he lay a fleece before the Lord instead of obeying him. And Hunter will help you exegete that passage a little bit later on. He also killed his fellow Israelites because they didn't give him any soldiers bread. I mean, if you remember that part of the story, he's chasing some of his enemies, he goes past some of his Israelites, he said, give us some bread. They say no. He says, I'm coming back to you. He goes and he gets his enemies, he comes back and he says, because you didn't give me bread, I'm going to kill all of you. And he kills them. And afterwards, what does Gideon do? They say, please be our king. He says, no, I'm not really into that kind of thing, but this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to create this golden ephod, this golden statue almost. And it became a stumbling block to him. And all of Israel worshipped this idol instead of worshipping God. After Gideon came Jephthah, who was a mighty warrior, except he treated God as though God was a Canaanite idol. And so he says to God, God, if you will deliver my enemies into my hand, I will sacrifice a burnt offering to you, the first thing that comes out of my door when I get home. And so he goes and he's victorious in battle. He comes home and his daughter comes out to greet him and he starts to cry. I mean, who did he think was going to greet him when he got home? The dog? He must have known that it would have been a person who was going to come and greet him. His daughter comes out, she says, what you have promised to God, you must do. And he sacrifices his own daughter. Now, is that something that God is recommending for us to do? No, of course not. See, Jephthah did not know the Lord. He sacrificed his own daughter. And finally, there is Samson. Proud, arrogant, violent, deceptive, disrespectful to his own parents. And the list goes on. He was perhaps the worst of all the judges in terms of moral character. He lied to his parents when he made them eat the honey from the lion. He broke his Nazarite vow in that same instance. After he makes a bet with the Canaanite men who were having a big drinking party with him, he loses the bet and he goes and kills 30 men from Ashkelon to steal their clothes from them so he could pay off his debt. Afterwards, he gets really upset with the Philistines for burning his wife and his father-in-law down. He ties a bunch of foxes together and sends them into their fields. The Philistines get so upset, they burn his wife and father-in-law alive. And so he gets upset with them, and so he kills a whole lot of them, and he runs away afterwards. And they come chasing him. The men of Judah hand Samson over to them. He picks up a jawbone of a donkey, kills 1,000 of them, and starts complaining to God. Lord, you've given me this great battle, but you're just going to leave me here to die. And so God provides for him yet again. He goes down and sleeps with a prostitute, at least one prostitute that we know about. And after that, he eventually gets into an adulterous relationship with Delilah. He tells her his secret of his great power, and the Philistines come and arrest him. They gouge out his eyes, and they keep him in the temple of Dagon. And at the end of his life, what does he say to God? God, give me my strength again. For what purpose? That I can take vengeance on the Philistines for cutting out my eyes. Kills 3,000 men and women of the Philistines, destroys the temple of Dagon. And so he's not really a role model for us to follow, but his story is actually very important. Of course, God is demonstrating that he can use sinners to accomplish his great purpose. Yes. Yes. But he's showing us something even more. See, through the stories of Barak and Othniel, he shows how great he is by delivering his people and how merciful he is by restoring his people. Through the story of Gideon, God shows how great he is by saving Israel, not through a great army, but through just 300 men who did not even have to draw their swords to send their oppressors into flight. And through the story of Samson, he shows how he can use just one man to deliver his people. Reminds you of another man who would come later, doesn't it? The story of Samson, you have an angel coming to Samson's parents saying, I'm going to give you a child, and he's going to start to save his people from the Philistines. The story of Jesus Christ, you have an angel coming to Mary. You're going to have a child, and he's going to save his people from their sins. Therefore, call his name Jesus. After Samson, we read of Israel's total decay into self-inflicted anarchy. You don't have to go very far from the story to read it. You see this in Judges chapter 17. There's this Levite who's serving in the house of Micah. And the men of Dan, one of the tribes of Israel, come and kidnap him. And they say to Micah and his household, listen, we got more swords than you. Don't even try and take this guy back. They go and they kill a whole bunch of people in the valley of Sorek. And this Levite mediates between the tribe of Dan and an idol. A Levite, someone who is meant to mediate between the people of God and Yahweh, is now mediating between a tribe of Israel and a false god. After that, we read of how the Levites went even further into decay when one Levite is camping in a tribe with the tribe of Benjamin. And the Benjaminites come to him so that they can gang rape him one night. The people of God, right? The covenant seed-carrying people of God come to gang rape a priest in the middle of the night. What is this priest's response? Well, he's got this concubine. Go out and satisfy these men. They abuse that woman all night long so that she crawls to the door of the house. He gets up in the morning. He sees her lying there, this Levite, this man of God, and says to her, get up. Let's go. You see, she's dead. A little bit upset about that. So he chops her body up, sends it all over Israel, which results in a civil war. The people of God. These people who are meant to be a blessing to the world. These people who are meant to deliver us from the curse, from the fall. These people who have come through Noah, through Abraham, through God's mighty deliverance in Egypt, acting in this way. The people of Israel had a big problem, and it wasn't their captives. It wasn't the Philistines. It wasn't the Canaanites. It was their own wicked hearts. Mm-hmm. Even when captivity is not a problem, even when the Philistines are not fighting against them, what do? They fight against themselves. Yeah. In fact, for them, captivity wasn't always such a big issue. When Samson killed the Philistines, the men of Judah get upset with him. Don't you know that these people are ruling over us? Go and hand yourself over to these people. These were the people of God. And the end of the book of Judges rings true. In those days, there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. The author of Judges is setting the stage for the rest of Israel's history. They needed a king who knew God's law, who would maintain true justice and bring them true peace. After the book of Judges ends, the first king of Israel, Saul, is inaugurated. He is the people's king. But he did not bring them peace, and he did not establish true justice according to God's law. The king whom God chose was David, and he typified the great king who would come and be a blessing to the nations of the earth. But David himself was not that king. However, God does tell David that his lineage would possess the great king who would bring peace to the people of God. Of course, those who know the story of the Bible are aware that none of David's descendants really exceed in righteousness. And the story of Israel, even under kingly rulers, continues to show the moral decay of God's people. And they degenerate to the point that there is only really one tribe of prominence left by the end of the Old Testament, and that is Judah. And that's quite clear in 2 Kings chapter 18. Yeah. Yet through Israel's failure, God kept promising to send a king to reign on the throne of David, who would bring peace to his people, who would bring deliverance from sin, and uphold God's perfect righteous laws. One such prophecy is found in the book of Isaiah, chapter 9, verse 7, prophesying about this great king who would come. Of the increase of his government and of peace there will be no end. On the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and uphold it with justice and with righteousness from this time forth and forevermore. And this prophecy was ultimately fulfilled by Jesus Christ himself. He said in Luke 24:27, and beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to them what was said in the scriptures concerning himself. Jesus claimed of himself in Matthew 28 verse 18 that he is the one who possesses all authority in heaven and on earth. He is the judge of all the world in Matthew chapter 25, verses 31 and following. He is the one who has power to forgive people of their sins in Mark chapter 2, verse 5. In fact, this Jesus Christ will be worshipped by every knee and every tongue who will bow down before him and declare that he is Lord. Philippians chapter 2, verses 10 and 11. And so what is the big picture? God will save mankind through the seed of the woman, the nation of Israel, the king from the line of David, Jesus Christ. The book of Judges is the connecting point between wandering and lost, wicked, apostate Israel and the lineage of kings who would come to usher in Christ and his great kingdom. These are all essential
to set the stage for the coming of Jesus Christ, to whom Israel, Abraham, and David all looked for salvation from toil, death, and sin. And friends, if you miss this, you will miss the book of Judges. The book of Judges will make no sense. You'll read the book of Judges and look for immoral stories. You'll read the book of Judges and you might come out the other end as an atheist, in fact, as some people have. They point to Jephthah and they say, look at that. Look at how God can allow somebody to sacrifice his own daughter. Is that the God you serve? You see, they have no idea about the great story of redemption that God is busy inaugurating to save mankind. And if you miss this, you'll miss everything, as we'll continue to explain throughout the rest of today. Are there any questions about the book of Judges or redemptive history at this point? Is it clear?
Yeah.
All right. This is setting the stage, the foundation. Next, we will have tea. Can you guys just make sure that the water is all ready and hot and the biscuits are put out as well? Next, we will have tea. We'll have a short 15-minute break. And then Hunter will give you a lesson on exegesis, teaching you how to read out from the text. And then I will take you through how you would preach a sermon on the book of Judges, particularly from the life of Samson. What do you do with Samson, that complicated man? How do you preach on that story? And then after that, we will continue to dig more specifically into the book of Judges. And at the end of the day, hopefully you will have a nice sermon outline that you can preach in your own churches if you so feel that you would like to do that.